And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is September the 14th. It's the 257th day of the year. Leap year is 258th day. Only 108 days remain to the end of the year. This year is fast winding down, folks. In the year AD 81, Domitian becomes emperor of the Roman Empire when his brother Titus died. You always have to wonder how these leaders died. Did they have help? 629, Emperor Heraclius enters Constantinople after beating the Persian Empire. 786, Knight of the Three Caliphs. Harun al-Rashid becomes the Abbasid Caliph on the death of his brother al-Hadi. And that same night, Harun's son, al-Mamun, was born. 919, Battle of Island Bridge. High King Nail Glundub is killed by leading an Irish coalition against the Vikings of Ul-Imer, led by the King Sitric Caich. 1180, the Glenpie War. Battle of Ishibashiyama in Japan. 1402, Battle of Hamilton Hill results in an English victory over Scotland. 1607, Flight of the Earls from Loch Sully, Donegal, Ireland. When in doubt, run. 1682, Bishop Gore School, one of the oldest schools in Wales, is founded. 1723, Grand Master Antonio Manolo de Vilhena lays down the first stone of Fort Manola in Malta. He was Grand Master of the Knights of Malta. 1741, George Frederick Handel completes his oratorio, Messiah. 1752, the British Empire adopts the Gregorian calendar. Skips 11 days. Went from September 2nd, 1752, to September 14th, almost overnight. 1763, Seneca warriors defeat British forces at the Battle of Devil's Hole during Pontiac's War. 1782, American Revolutionary War. Review of the French troops under General Rochambeau by George Washington at Verplanck's Point in New York. 1791, the Papal States lose Avignon to the Revolutionary France. 1808, the Finnish War. Russians defeat the Swedes at the Battle of Orivais. 1812, Napoleonic Wars. The French Grand Army enters Moscow. The fire of Moscow begins as soon as Russian troops leave the city. 1814, Battle of Baltimore. The poem Defense of Fort McHenry is written by Francis Scott Key, and it's used as the lyrics of the Star-Spangled Banner. Nowhere does it say you're supposed to kneel when it's sung. 1829, the Ottoman Empire signs a treaty of Adrianople with Russia, ends the Russo-Turkish War. 1846, Jang Bahadur and his brothers massacre about 40 members of the Nepalese palace court. 1862, American Civil War. The Battle of South Mountain, part of the Maryland Campaign, is fought. 1901, President McKinley dies after being wounded on September 6th by anarchist Leon Gogolz and is succeeded by Vice President Theodore Roosevelt. 1914, HMAS AE-1, the Royal Australian Navy's first submarine, is lost at sea with all hands near East New Britain in Papua New Guinea. 1917, the Russian Empire is formally replaced by the Russian Republic. 1936, Raoul Villain assassinated the French socialist Jean Jaurès, is himself killed by Spanish Republicans in Ambaza. 1939, World War II, the Estonian military boards the Polish submarine ORP Orzel in to Lynn, sparking a diplomatic incident that the Soviet Union will use to justify the annexation of Estonia. 1940, the Ypres Massacre. Hungarian army, supported by local Hungarians, killed 158 Romanian citizens in Ypres, Salaj, a village in northern Transylvania. It's an act of ethnic cleansing. We're starting to see a lot of that these days. 1943, World War II, the Wehrmacht starts a three-day retaliatory operation targeting several Greek villages in the region of Vianos. The death toll would eventually exceed 500. 1942, World War II, Maastricht becomes the first Dutch city to be liberated by Allied forces. 1948, the Indian Army captures the city of Aurangabad as part of Operation Polo. 1954, a top-secret nuclear test. A Soviet Tu-4 bomber drops a 40-kiloton atomic weapon just north of Trotskoy village. 1958, the first two German post-war rockets designed by the German pioneer Ernst Mayr reach the upper atmosphere. 1959, the Soviet probe Lunar 2 crashes onto the moon. Becomes the first man-made object that we know of to reach it. 1960, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, is founded. 1960, Congo crisis. Mobutu Sese Seko seizes power in a military coup, suspends parliament and the constitution. 1975, the first American saint, Elizabeth Ann Seton, is canonized by Pope Paul VI. 1979, Afghan President Nur Muhammad Taraki is assassinated on the order of Hafizullah Amin to become the new president. 1982, President-elect of Lebanon, Bakir Gemel, is assassinated. 1984, Joe Kittinger becomes the first person to fly a gas balloon alone across the Atlantic Ocean. 1985, Penang Bridge, the longest bridge in Malaysia connecting the island of Penang to the mainland, opens up to traffic. 1989, the Standard Gravure shooting where Joseph T. Westbacker, a 47-year-old press man, killed 8 people and injured 12 people at his former workplace, Standard Gravure, before committing suicide. 1982, Constitutional Court of Bosnia and Herzegovina declares the breakaway Croatian Republic of Herz Bosnia to be illegal. 1993, Lufthansa Flight 2904, an Airbus A320, crashes into an embankment after overshooting the runway at Okeechi International Airport, which is now the Warsaw Chopin Airport, kills 2 people. 1994, the Major League Baseball season is canceled because of a strike. 1997, 81 people killed as 5 bogeys of the Ahmedabad Howrah Express plunge into a river in Bilaspur district in Madhya Pradesh, India. 1998, telecommunications companies MCI Communication and WorldCom complete their $37 billion merger to form MCI WorldCom. 1999, Kiribati, Nauru, and Tonga join the United Nations. 2000, Windows releases Windows Me, or Microsoft does. 2001, historic national prayer service held at Washington National Cathedral for victims of the September 11th attacks. Similar service is held in Canada on Parliament Hill, the largest vigil ever held in the nation's capital. 2003, in a referendum, Estonia approves joining the European Union. Bet they regret that now. 2007, financial crisis of 2007-08, the Northern Rock Bank experiences the first bank run in the UK in 150 years. 2015, the first observance of gravitational waves is made, announced by the LIGO and the Virgo collaborations on 11th February 2016. 2019, Yemen's Houthi rebels claim responsibility for an attack on Saudi Arabian oil facilities. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Far too many to go over. Christian Feast Day, Elia Flacilla in the Eastern Orthodox Church, Cormac Mac, Quirinian, Crescentius of Rome, Feast of the Cross, and also an Eastern Orthodox Elevation of the Holy Cross. Formerly, the Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday following September 14th were observed as one of the four sets of Ember Days. In the first Irish calendar, they were known as the Quarter Tents in the Roman Catholic and Anglican churches. Lord of Miracles of Buga, Louis Gabriel Turin Dufresne, one of the martyr saints of China. Maternus of Cologne, not Booger. Engineers Day in Romania. Hindi Day in the Hindi-speaking states of India. Mobilized Servicemen Day in Ukraine. And San Jacinto Day in Nicaragua. Of course, we're talking about quite a lot of unusual observances on this particular date. The 1936, the first prefrontal lobotomy in America, performed by Walter Freeman and James Watts at George Washington University Hospital in Washington, D.C. And my guess is that person they operated on went on to become a member of Congress. The world's first practical helicopter, the VS-300, designed by Igor Sikorsky, takes flight in Stratford, Connecticut. 1949, India's Constituent Assembly adopts Hindi as an official language. 1956, IBM introduces the Ramach 305, the first commercial computer with a hard drive that uses magnetic disk storage. It was a small one, didn't weigh but a ton. 3 birthday. Amy Winehouse's birthday. A 14-year-old Texan Ahmad Muhammad arrested at school when a homemade clock is assumed to be a bomb. This was in 2015. Mark Zuckerberg and Obama sent supportive tweets. You have every right to carry a bomb to school. And on this date, 1962, Janet Leigh divorces actor Tony Curtis after 10 years of marriage. And in 1984, John Carpenter and actress Adrienne Barbeau divorce after 5 years of marriage. James Fenimore Cooper died on this date. Arthur Wellesley died on this date. Aaron Burr, William McKinley, Grace Kelly died on this date in 1982. And Janet Gaynor, who was one of the better actresses and dancers in Hollywood. Now, let's see what else we got, if anything. Okay. Back up. In 891, Stephen V ends his reign as the Catholic Pope. 1136, Pastor Frederick forms a convent at Maringard in Friesland. 1515, battle at Marigano ends in a French-Venetian victory. 1629, the Spanish garrison at Hertogenbosch surrenders to Frederick Henry, the Prince of Orange. 1716, the first lighthouse in America lit Boston Harbor. 1 which is not supposed to happen. There's the problem. Okay. Okay, let's back up from that. Okay. 1759, Austrian troops occupied Dresden. 1807, Aaron Burr acquitted of a misdemeanor charge. 1814, Francis Scott Key wrote the poem Defense of Fort Henry after witnessing the bombardment of Fort Henry. 1847, U.S. Marines under General Scott enters Mexico City. That's where the Halls of Montezuma came from. 1848, Alexander Stewart opens the first U.S. department store. Alrighty. Well, we got a few things to finish up on. You know, talking about strange encounters, sometimes people encounter things totally unexpected and they vanish. Take, for example, the afternoon of December 5th, 1945. Perfect flying weather over Florida. Unlimited visibility. And at 8 minutes past two that afternoon, five Grumman Avenger torpedo bombers flew off from Fort Lauderdale on a routine training mission. Planes were in excellent condition. Pilots are all veterans who had hundreds of hours flying time behind them. They had all been veterans of the war. And one radio message, the last these pilots ever sent, suddenly came across the air. It was an almost unintelligible message, broadcast from an inexplicably static charge wavelength. It shouldn't have been static charged. The voice was Flight Commander Charles Taylor. He said, "My God, we can't see. I don't know where we are. The instruments are crazy." Then they lost radio contact. Immediately, an emergency operations swung into action at Fort Lauderdale. Crews in the operations towers tried frantically to contact the five Avengers. For the next few minutes, the static sound waves reached an unheard-of pitch, drowning out all human voices. And then the static died away. They heard men's voices talking to each other. No doubt it was the Avenger pilots talking. But they were all shouting, and they didn't seem to hear the tower. Then the static interference came back and died away again, and this time it took with it all traces of the five aircraft. Now, not able to believe all five planes would lose contact with the tower at one time, radio operators kept up their efforts to get out of their signals. And if the Avengers kept their flight instructions, they should have been less than half an hour's flying time from the base. So later units, Coast Guard stations, other aircraft asked to keep watch out for them. But there was simply no sign of these missing planes, even from the radar scanners that scoured an area extending for hundreds of miles in all directions. And just when everybody was giving the Avenger planes up for lost, and a seaplane was preparing to launch a search for the survivors, one radio operator heard something. Faintly, indistinctly, from what seemed to be hundreds of miles beyond the limits of the radar scanners, he heard a Mayday signal, and then a voice. It was Commander Taylor. He said, "We're lost. There's nothing to see. Nothing anywhere." And that was the last contact. Well, taking a bearing off that signal, a giant Mariner flying boat seaplane took off from the Naval Air Station at Banana River Base and went off to find the missing Avengers. And it flew into oblivion the same as did the Avenger Grumman Avenger torpedo bombers. The last message received from the Mariner was that it was approaching the search area, the same area pinpointed as being that from which the Avenger's last message was received, and the Mariner confirmed it was on course. Weather was good, and then the message ended. Pilot didn't even have time to sign off. It was just gone. It was neither seen nor heard from again. If anything, the disappearance of the Mariner flying boat was even more mysterious than that of the vanished Avengers. Because if the Avengers had been flying close together, collision could have been possible. But that wouldn't have explained all the strange messages. And at one point, Taylor handed over command to another pilot. Now, what commander does that? I mean, Frank, you know, with the Avengers, a collision, as I say, could have been possible, and the planes could have crashed into the sea. But the Mariner, though, had four experienced officers, a crew of nine, and if it had an emergency, it could have landed on the sea. But if all six planes had fallen into the sea, there would have been some trace, some clue, whether an oil slick or debris. But the 600 aircraft, submarine ships, and boats that went scouring that area less than an hour later discovered absolutely nothing. And they searched for miles off the Florida coast. All reports said the ocean was as placid and peaceful looking as a mill pond. Nothing to be seen at all to even suggest any sea disaster taking place. And what followed was the most intensive air-sea rescue operation the world had ever known. Lasted for more than a week and covered more than 30,000 square miles of ocean and shoreline. Troops and civilians even hiked along thousands of miles of shoreline looking for debris, flotsam, oil, even bodies. But the millions of dollars spent on the search operation revealed not one hint of the causes of this disaster. A Naval Board of Inquiry spent many more weeks investigating and probing and checking and double-checking weather conditions, maintenance reports on the planes. They even looked at the biographies of each of the men involved. But when all was said and done, the board couldn't even imagine what might have happened. And to this day, nobody's ever come up with an answer to the greatest mystery of the air. What happened to five warplanes and a rescue plane? Well, let's turn from vanished aircraft to a ghostly encounter. Albert Wagstaff's house was just one of many small terraced houses that were built in a mining village a few miles from Barnsley in Yorkshire, in England. The row of houses of the Wagstaffs occupied faced a long, desolate stretch of moorland. And even in 1920, they were old houses. Many of them, especially those neighboring the Wagstaffs, were condemned and unoccupied. That's why Eleanor Wagstaff woke up late one night, very much surprised at what awoke her. She could hear the faint wailing of a baby. Now, it was 4 o'clock in the morning, but the weeping persisted. At times, it was so close that it seemed to come from their own house, but they didn't have any children. Later, she said it sounded almost like somebody's walking outside, up and down, carrying the child. And the poor baby sounds as if it is ill. Well, her husband responded, "It's not our business. Let's be getting off to sleep again." And though he paid no attention, the next morning she chatted to the milkman about the sobbing baby she and Albert had heard the night before. Milkman responded in some surprise. He said, "That's two odd things I've heard about this morning." He said, "My boss keeps one cow that he milks for his own use, but this morning he found somebody milked it before he could." Now, coupled with the strange sounds of the crying child, this bit of information made Eleanor wonder what was going on. Well, the following night, the Wagstaffs were again awoken by the pitiful crying of a baby. Eleanor went to the window to peer out, and even though it was a bright moonlit night, she couldn't see anybody anywhere. And the sound went on for so long, Albert and his wife got dressed and went outside to find out where the noise was coming from. Now, they searched all around. They didn't find anything, but they could still hear the child crying. Well, Albert finally said there's no such thing as ghosts, so it has to be some kind of bird. But Eleanor said, if I don't know the sound of a crying child by now, then I think it's time I did. Well, the following night, the sounds were heard again. Albert once more went outside and searched. When he came back, he showed Eleanor he had actually found something beside the house. A small, knitted baby shoe. He said, well, that should convince you it's no ghost. That's real enough, isn't it? Well, by this point in time, it will convince that some poor woman, maybe somebody who didn't have a home to go to, was wandering around at night with her baby. And they decided it had to have been the same woman that milked the farmer's cow to get milk for her child. Well, they decided if they heard the sounds of the crying child once again, they'd get up and solve the mystery once and for all. And the next night, regular as clockwork, the baby began to cry again. Albert said, whoever she is, that woman must make her way to that cow for milk. We'll go see what we can do to help her. Well, when they got near the farm, they saw the cow grazing in the field. But they saw something else. There couldn't be any mistake about it. It was a clear moonlit night. There was a woman milking the cow. And they waited till the woman started to walk across the field carrying what appeared to be a bowl in her hands. She stopped close to a hedge and stooped and lifted out a baby. Well, Eleanor ran toward the pair, but before she could get to them, they vanished as if they'd never been there. It took some time for Eleanor to recover from that shock, but when they searched the hedgerow where they had seen the woman pick up the baby, they found an old wooden bowl. It wasn't until some weeks later they learned the story from somebody who had lived in the area for a long time. A young married woman had lived at the farm 50 years before. Well, when her husband died, she wandered the countryside with her child till one morning she was found dead in the ditch, still holding the baby that was crying pitifully. The child was raised by kindly farmers as her own child. He never knew his real mother, who died to try to keep him alive. Well, sometimes we make promises and later forget them. Patty Hayes is such a person. In the summer of 1887, he was feeling good. It had been a remarkably good year for him. He watched his farm labor storing the wheat in his barns. As he's working out how much it was all worth to him, the piercing scream came from inside the barn. He heard scream follow scream and the sound of scuffling and men cursing as he came into the farmyard. And before he could get there to investigate, his workers met him running out of the barn. Stopping one of them in his headlong flight, Hayes asked what was wrong. Wide-eyed man looked at him, glanced fearfully over his shoulder at the barn, and said they'd been frightened by a ghost. Well, angry at what he was sure was just complete stupidity, Hayes marched into the barn to see exactly what was going on. Then he stopped, just inside the door. And as his eyes adjusted themselves to the dim light, he got the shock of his life. Sitting on top of the bales of wheat was his wife, or whether his wife's ethereal ghostly outline. See, she was already dead. On seeing him, the ghost stood up, stared at him accusingly, pointed a warning finger at him, and vanished. See, it was a large, prosperous farm near County Down, Ireland, that Patty Hayes owned. Consequently, the family had lots of money and lived well, but Patty really didn't give a tinker's damn about anybody else's welfare. He was not a charitable man. Now, his wife, Maureen, though, was the very opposite and very well known in the county for her good work for various charities. And noting how severe her husband was with his workers, she always did what she could to help him in their difficulties. Strangely enough, Patty never tried to prevent her from doing this, what he called her social work. Well, as she got older, Marine began to worry about what might happen to her people if she should die, because she knew Patty'd never help them. Eventually, she tried to persuade her husband to give her just one of his fields so she could have wheat sown every year and used to make bread to be given to the poor. It's almost as if she knew she was going to die soon. Well, at first, he refused her strange request, but when she hinted her request to probably be the very last thing she'd ever ask of him, he became alarmed and gave in to her pleading. Now, he was reluctant to part with any of his land, but he realized his wife was ill. A few days later, though, he regretted his promise and tried to make a bargain with her. He promised to give her all the fields she could walk around during the next 3 days. Yeah, it seemed to be a pretty safe bargain to make, because by this time, Irene was sick in her bed. Following morning, Patty awoke to find out that his wife had vanished from her bed. Rushing outside the house, he was astonished to see her still wearing her nightdress without any slippers, walking around one of his best fields. It was a cold, misty morning, and when Patty rushed over to her, Irene collapsed in his arms, just as she had completed walking around his largest, most fertile field. Well, as she lay in her bed, feverish from the chill she'd caught that very morning, she made Patty promise to keep his promise. She wanted that field to be used for growing wheat for the food for the poor of the district. Then Marine died, happily knowing that Patty had given her his promise. Well, it was a few months later, though, when the harvest of the wheat was being reaped, he changed his mind. After all, he reasoned to himself it was his best field, and had never been in such an abundant, healthy harvest for years. So why should he give it away? So instead of giving it to the local almshouse, he had his labor stored away in his barn. And that was when his wife returned from the grave. Now, Patty Hayes was a hard man. In fact, many said he was a ruthless man in many ways, but the sight of Marine's ghost was a shock. When his foreman came into the barn, having heard about the ghost from the laborers, he found Patty on his knees, his face buried in his hands. First thing the next morning, several wagon loads of wheat were delivered from the Hayes farm to the poorhouse and nearby newery. And after that, Patty kept up the custom for the rest of his life. Lorraine got what she wanted. Well, sometimes things that attract our attention, not really what they seem. Case in point, the ruined castle in the Norfolk village of Bradwell. When Robson heard about that castle, they decided it was worth making a detour from their journey simply to explore the place. I mean, after all, it was the sort of thing that fascinated them all, as Wade Robinson was an enthusiastic amateur archaeologist, and his wife Estelle's hobby was landscape photography. Well, in this particular case, their 13-year-old son, Rupert, was with them on this holiday. So they stopped at a roadhouse on their way to Bradwell for a bite of lunch, and when the landlord heard where they were going, his affable manner changed abruptly. Strange look came across his face at the mere mention of Berg Castle. Yes, you don't find much to interest you there. There are only some ruined walls standing. Place used to attract a lot of visitors at one time, but not anymore. In fact, few people go there now. Well, when they started back on their journey, Mr. Robson remarked to his wife, that man had something on his mind. You notice how he changed as soon as we mentioned going to Bird Castle? Estelle nodded and said, yeah, it's almost as if he was afraid of something. But after a while, as we tend to do, they forgot about the incident. They reached the castle after parking their car and walking for some miles across fields. And at first, they were the only people looking around the ruins. Then they met a young man. Appeared to be about 19, dressed in leather motorcyclist clothes and carrying a pair of leather gauntlets. For a time, he trailed them around the ruins, keeping a few paces behind them, and every time they stopped to look closely at something, some particular part of the ruins, he'd stop. Then it became quite embarrassing. It was as though the young man had attached himself to him because he was lonely, but he didn't speak to him, pass any comments, which made him think he must be really shy. Presently, Miss Robson whispered to her husband, do you think we ought to speak to him? After all, he is following us around, and maybe he's lonely, but too timid to speak. Robson said, "Well, I don't know. I'm surprised to see a young man like him here at all. Probably arranged to meet his girlfriend here." And then Rupert spoke up and said, "Well, you know, it's funny. I didn't hear his motorcycle or notice it at all, anywhere." "Well, Miss Robson been taking some photographs during the visit, including one or two, with the motorcyclist in the background." And then suddenly they realized young man was no longer there. He'd vanished. And by the time they'd finished exploring the castle, it was early evening, just in time to drive back to that roadhouse for dinner. Well, the landlord was his usual cheerful self again. He welcomed them back, said, "With any other visitors at the castle besides yourself?" Rupert said, "Only one, and your man on a motorcycle." Mother said he wasn't on a motorbike, but he was merely wearing motorcyclist clothes. He seemed like a nice young man, though. Broke off, saw the landlord had certainly turned pale and looked as if he was about to faint. Wade Robson jumped to his feet full of concern. He said, "What's the matter? Are you feeling ill?" Man shook his head and said, "No, I'll be all right in a minute. It was just a shock when you said you'd seen the young man." Well, when the landlord recovered, he took a small snapshot from his pocket of a young man standing near a motorcycle and says, "Was this the boy you saw?" Ms. Robson studied the photograph and finally said, "Oh, yeah, it's a good picture of him." Well, the landlord said, "He was my nephew. Came to visit me from his home in London only a month ago. He was in a road accident and got killed." Well, a few weeks after their visit, Ms. Robson had her films developed. In several, the prince was the unmistakable figure of the motorcyclist, young man who had died a month before the photographs were even taken. It's interesting when ghosts can be caught on camera. Well, let's go to the Ferry Boat Inn at Hollywell in Huntingtonshire, one of Gordon Thomas's favorite haunts, because the 16th century hostelry, with all its thatched roof and old beams and large log fireplace, was a cozy place to pass a few hours on a cold winter's evening. And just before Christmas in 1958, that's exactly what he was doing one night. It was raining heavily outside, and as there were several people he knew in the bar, Gordon was in no hurry to leave for home. And as he moved to a seat closer to the fire, he glanced up and saw a very pretty girl of about 18 standing nearby. He was intrigued by the strange clothes she was wearing and imagined she must have been on her way to a masquerade ball. So to break the ice, to open the conversation, he said, "Where's the party, sweetheart? Can I come?" The girl turned to look at him when he spoke, and Gordon saw her face was very pale. She didn't answer, but she gave him what he took to be a freezing look. Going to the bar for another drink, Gordon spoke to the landlord. "It was the girl in the fancy dress," he said, and the landlord looked around and looked at Thomas and said, "Don't you think you've had enough? I can't see anybody." When Gordon looked around, the girl had gone. Intrigued, he went outside, but there was nobody to be seen in the parking lot either. Second time he saw the girl was a little after closing time, when everybody had gone except him and the landlord, and the doors were locked. This time the girl slowly materialized up from the middle of one of the stone floor slabs and then once again vanished. Well, convinced he'd seen a ghost, Gordon made some inquiries into the history of the inn and learned that the original building had been standing at the time of the Norman Conquest. Delving into parish records, interviewing older people in the village, he gradually pieced together a strange tale about a sad and very beautiful girl and learned that at some time, every century since 1066, there had been rumors of a ghost. The story ran that living in the village during the Norman Conquest was a beautiful girl named Eleanor Cobb. According to the legend, the girl was seduced by a Norman knight, and when she vanished, it was subsequently proven she'd been murdered by the Norman, who'd buried her body secretly under a stone slab in what became known as the Ferry Boat Inn. Well, the girl's remains had been removed and given a proper burial, but for more than 900 years, her spirit had been revisiting the scene of her murder. There are those that say that's not an unusual occurrence. Well, Have you ever seen Psychic Surgery? It's a very unusual procedure. I saw it once in South America. And in this particular story, we're talking about a psychic surgeon in Latin America. Now, a rusty tin can containing a pair of tailor's cutting shears, an old carving knife, tweezers, and a scalpel were standing in the middle of a stained plank table. On a nearby door, which was lying flat on trestles, was a woman who was suffering from cancer. The tools in the can were the instruments which were to be used in a surgical procedure. The cancer victim was the patient. The surgeon was a plump Brazilian farm laborer named Fritz Arrigo. Mingling with the peasants who were crowding around the cottage room were several of the most famous surgeons and doctors in Latin America. And they were there to witness an experiment in the incredible. See, Fritz Arrigo was the surgeon who performed miracles. He'd operated successfully on people under unsanitary conditions that would have frightened any properly qualified surgeon. Gave his patients no anesthetic, but the carving knife plunging into her cancerous breast didn't cause the woman to give any sign she felt any pain. As the blood spurted from the wound, Arrigo passed the palm of his hand over her breast and the bleeding stopped. Then he continued to carry on quite calmly with the operation. In a matter of minutes, he was able to insert his tweezers into the gaping wound and withdraw a long piece of tissue, the cancerous growth. Then stitching the incision with a darning needle and tarred string, he sent the woman home again. A number of weeks later, she was examined by a skilled surgeon. He was astounded to see the operation had been a resounding success. There was not the least sign of infection or cancer, and the doctors were amazed to see the woman was pregnant. Later, when the child was born, she was seen breastfeeding it from the breast that had been cut open and operated on by the miracle man, Fritz Arrigo. Now, this all sounds too incredible to be true, but highly reputable scientists and surgeons have witnessed to his operations, and not one of the peasants whom he's treated has been known to have died as a result. In fact, all have been completely cured by the most serious complaints. Dr. Lex, a lecturer in surgery at the Sao Paulo Medical School in Brazil, has even assisted Arrigo in one operation. It was a complicated eye operation on a child, which would have defeated many surgeons because of its delicate nature. In fact, Lex held the child's head while Arrigo operated and watched as Arrigo, calm and cool, thrust a pair of small scissors in behind the boy's eyeball. Blood spouted out, of course, but Arrigo only picked up a ball of cotton wool, wiped it over the eye, and the bleeding stopped. And he calmly carried on with an operation that would have defeated the skills of many trained surgeons. Again, it was 100% successful, completed in a matter of minutes, and it saved a young boy's eyesight. It was apparently painless and carried out without any anesthetic. Next recorded in a report, the child just walked into a barn, climbed onto a bench, and laid back to let Arrigo do his best. Now, something's just as strange as the incredible operations is the fact that Fritz Arrigo's performed them all in a state of trance. And when he recovers afterwards, he has no memory of the miracles he's just performed. On one occasion, when an official from a United Nations organization, a police official, and Dr. Lex were present, Arrigo recovered from a brain tumor operation and saw his blood-stained hands. A look of horror spread across his own face, and he fainted. He said on many occasions he can't stand the sight of blood. But how does he perform his miracles? According to Arrigo, his body and mind are taken over by the ghost of a German surgeon who was killed during the First World War. Now, Arrigo can't speak German, as various investigators have proven, but during his operation, he gives instructions to himself in fluent German. Another ghost assists him, he says, by sterilizing the instruments, cleaning the operating theater, and stopping the blood from flowing by shining a spiritual green light, which also acts as an anesthetic. This assistant is said to be the ghost of a famous medical missionary who was murdered in Mexico 200 years ago. This assistant is the friar Fabiano de Cristo. Now, Rigo's identified both spirits after his trance-like states, but the experts who investigated his claims have been puzzled by the illiterate peasant's knowledge of these two men. You see, you can't read, and there's no way of knowing so many intimate details about the two men. His career as a miracle worker started in 1950, and until early in 1967, he's regarded as a saint by the Brazilian peasants among whom he lived. In fact, they still regard him with superstitious awe, but Rigo's no longer with them. As his fame spread and reports of his activities reached the authorities, he was charged with illegally practicing medicine, prescribing medicines, and performing illegal operations. Now, this caused such an outcry, and so many doctors gave evidence on his behalf. The charges were changed to one of witchcraft. He was sentenced to jail for 3 years for practicing witchcraft. But even in prison, his powers were still at work. One rumor leaked out that during a prison riot, one guard had his throat slashed with a razor. Fritz Rigo bent over the dying man, pressed the wound together with his hands, and the bleeding stopped. He kept the man alive, and by the time he got to the hospital, the wound was actually healing. Psychic believers or some doctors believe Rigo to be a miracle worker who has divine guidance. Others claim, of course, he is a charlatan and a witch doctor. But nobody, and I mean nobody, can explain the mystery that still surrounds him. The mystery of the illiterate peasant who performed successful operations of rusty household utensils and didn't lose a single patient. Well, we've all heard about alchemists who change lead into gold. You know, back in the 30s, it was a worldwide search for a man known only as Falconelli. A man with a secret that could be worth millions and possibly billions. It's a search which is still going on because the mysterious Falconelli is claimed to be still alive. And only one man knows where he might be, and that one man steadfastly refuses to tell. Now, the four people who observed Falconelli's last public appearance just before he vanished in the autumn of 1937 are still leading the search to find him. They were present in the specially equipped laboratory in the French Chateau de l'Air near Bourges on the day Falconelli, in a flowing alchemist gown, was said to have transmuted 250 grams of lead into gold and 100 grams of silver into uranium. He's said to have achieved this miraculous event with the aid of an unknown substance which he claimed to have been extracted from 2 pounds of iron pyrite. If it was a trick, it was certainly one of breathtaking skill. The four witnesses, two physicists, a chemist, and a geologist, together with the chateau owner, Pierre de Lesseps, descendant of the Suez Canal builder, supervised each stage of the experiment and examined the resulting minerals. Now, today, alchemy can no longer be dismissed out of hand. In fact, many leading scientists believe the ancient alchemist who claimed to be able to transmute base metals into silver and gold might possibly have held the key to secrets that are baffling present-day technologists. That's why the search for the elusive Falconelli is still pursued so vigorously. Even the U.S. Secret Service has scoured France, interviewing everyone who's ever made contact with the mysterious alchemist. Soon after the experiment at Bourges, Professor René Heilbronner, a member of the Faculty of Science in Paris and one of the pioneers of atomic research, was visited by Falconelli in his laboratory. He told Heilbronner he was one of the last alchemists and that he had been closely following a scientist's work on the atom. He came to deliver a warning. The results of Heilbronner's work must be kept secret or there'd be a terrible threat to humanity. Well, when Heilbronner remained skeptical, Falconelli took a parchment from his pocket and read from it a paragraph written by the alchemist Roger Bacon in the 13th century. He said, "A small quantity of matter suitably prepared to produce a terrible explosion accompanied by an intense light. In this way, a city or even an entire army may be destroyed in an instant." Sounds to me like we're talking about nuclear weapons. Falconelli went on to say the alchemist had long known the answers to the secrets Heilbronner and his fellow scientists were trying to unlock. They'd even advanced much further in knowledge, manipulation of energy, and acquired stupendous powers. few weeks later, Falconelli vanished, leaving his affairs in the hands of his disciple, Eugene Cancelet, who now lives in the little village of Savenay, not far from Beauvais. Cancelet absolutely refuses to reveal his master's true identity and present whereabouts. Falconelli's book, still sold in great numbers in an original edition, if it could be found, would be worth as much as $10,000. Just before the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, the U.S. government's agents in France stepped up their efforts to find Falconelli, but he'd absolutely vanished. They couldn't find a trace of him. Since then, every attempt to find or identify him has only served to deepen the mystery. Incredible as it may seem, the occult science of the medieval gold makers is now the subject of intensive research by scientists, business enterprises, and even governments. Searches primarily for centuries-old documents in which the alchemists, sworn never to reveal details of their work under pain of death, set down the results of their experiments in symbolic terms. Western Germany, companies such as IG Farben Industrie and Badisch Annalen have scoured the libraries and archives in the quest for such documents. In the Soviet Union, a special scientific department under the direction of Professor Nicholas Giroff have been given the task of translating and deciphering similar works. Search for old alchemical documents has in fact become a leading objective in the sphere of East-West industrial espionage. What exactly did the ancient alchemists achieve to spark off such interest? Their main aim, of course, was to manufacture the famous Philosopher's Stone, the mysterious substance that brought about the process of transmutation. Most admitted failure. Others claimed to have succeeded, and there's considerable documentary evidence to support their claims. The most ancient, recent discovery to renew interest in alchemy was made by Professor Picardi and of the Florence Institute of Physicochemistry. He's found that radiation from outer space would, under favorable conditions, bring about a change or a transmutation of chemical substances. Moreover, scientists now know that life itself depends to some extent on the ancient alchemical laws. Transmutation of sodium into potassium in the human body is an example. Scientists are still unable to account for these phenomena, but they follow a pattern that's been known and demonstrated in alchemy for centuries. And although the alchemists jealously guarded the secrets of the process of transmutation, they talked freely about its principles. Principles that are in direct contradiction to many of the concepts on which modern science rests. And recently, fresh discoveries have given scientists cause to wonder if the alchemists were perhaps right after all. Wherever Falconelli is, and some even think he was lured behind the Iron Curtain, his secrets are being kept safe. Is it possible Falconelli is none other than the Count de Saint Germain, who's supposed to live forever? It would certainly explain a lot, because the Count de Saint Germain was also an alchemist. Well, let's talk about reincarnation. Scientists in South Africa have been trying for some time to unravel the remarkable memory possessed by a 12-year-old schoolgirl named Joey Verwey. You see, she remembered things that happened to her 100 years ago, even 1,000 years ago. In fact, some of her memories go far back as the days of the cavemen. So has Joey really lived before? Were the things she claims to remember or have been or been involved in simply childish chatter? This was certainly the impression everybody had at the time, but then things became so embarrassing for her parents that they decided something had to be done to curb Joey's too vivid imagination, especially after she met an 80-year-old woman who she never met before and claimed that woman had been her own daughter. In alarm, Joey's parents sought medical advice, and it was from this that Joey's case came to the attention of scholars and scientists of the caliber of Dr. Arthur Blexley of the University of Witwatersrand. See, Dr. Blexley heard about Joey's meeting with her daughter, and it interested him. But what excited him were the detailed accounts of Joey's other claims. For as it turned out, once some of her experiences of former lives were examined by eminent South African historians, the details and information are all so incredibly accurate, it seemed amazing a 12-year-old girl should have known about them. Joey is told how she was chased by a large, lumbering monster, a beast as she called it. She ran away not because she was afraid it would eat her, but because it was stampeding and it might have crushed her to death. She said the animal's as big as a house and drew a picture of it. And that picture uncannily resembled a dinosaur. Now, perhaps there's nothing odd about that, because many children's books have illustrations of dinosaurs. When she met that 80-year-old woman again in Dr. Blexley's office, it proved a meeting for the things that she told a woman in many cases were collaborated by letters and diaries and old photographs. It seemed that she really could have been the old woman's mother. Joy described the night of the woman's birth in Kilkeel County down in Ireland and how the woman's father had been drowned in the harbor the following morning when his fishing boat capsized in a storm. Well, this turned out to all be true. She was able to discuss with a fair amount of accuracy the fact that when her baby was only a few months old, she'd come to London where she'd married a schoolmaster. The old woman was so surprised by the accurate description of her stepfather, she fainted. Some weeks later, Joy was taken to Kruger House Museum in Pretoria by Dr. Blexley, and as they approached the building, she started to describe some of the rooms and their contents as they had been years before. Some of the rooms had been preserved just as she described them. Others had been changed, but evidence was eventually ferreted out by historians to prove her statements were all true. When asked how she knew all that, Joy replied, "Because I used to know the president, Paul Kruger, very well, and often stayed here as his guest." Well, Paul Kruger died in 1904, long before Joey's parents were even born. Later, Joey sketched a picture of Kruger House and showed it to Dr. Blexley, telling him it was the way she remembered the house and its environs. Once again, the investigations proved her claim to be amazingly accurate, for a faded old picture of Kruger House in 1900 was found in the Durban Museum. It was almost exactly what Joey had sketched. On another occasion, she's been questioned by some of Blexley's university colleagues about her former life as the wife of a Roman Legion officer. She described the dress and weapons of her husband's soldiers. Then she added as an afterthought, she remembered the leather shields were embossed with gold and copper. Immediately, one of the history professors proved that iron was a much more likely metal to be used then, and that Roman shields he had once seen had iron facings. Joey thought about that for a moment and said slowly, "No, I'm sure it was copper. You see, we didn't use iron in my day." Well, this puzzled the historian, who did some investigations of his own. He discovered that certain Roman regions actually did use copper, just as Joey had said. So the question is this lively, fun-loving girl the reincarnation of several women who lived at various times during the past few thousand years? Or maybe even further back in time itself? Or it's something that top scientists are continuing to investigate, and maybe we'll never know the truth. But one person convinced it's true, and that's Joey herself. She said she remembers. That's why she's so surprised that other people are inclined to accept her other existence skeptically. Blexley's notes on Joey's former lives could fill several books. For all in all, she's furnished evidence of almost 11 different lives beside her present one. In each case, she's shown a startling knowledge of detail that no child of her age could possibly be familiar with. With less important details, which the experts have had to search for through their records with painstaking care. But in every case, some collaboration, usually complete collaboration, has been found to back up Joy Verway's claims to have lived in this world before her current life. Is reincarnation a valid process? Only time will tell. We've come to the end of another show. We'll be back tomorrow, and once again, you'll be listening to stories told by Ken Hudnall on the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.